Well, this is Jeff Blankfort welcoming you to the March 23rd edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and usually every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. Next Wednesday, however, my spot behind the mic will be taken by Forthright Radio's Joy LeClaire from a far-off Montana. Well, first this morning, I want to thank all of you who pledged your support to KZYX and in particular to Takes on the World and Forthright Radio during our spring pledge fundraiser 2 weeks ago. It is your continuing support over the years that keeps Joy LeClaire and me bringing you the kind of public affairs program you're not likely to hear on many other radio stations. Yesterday, like me, I assume that many of you awoke to the news of the latest terrorist attack in Western Europe. This one in Brussels, with site of European Union headquarters. They came just days after the Belgian police had arrested the lone suspect still at large from the multiple shootings in Paris last November, which took 130 lives and was claimed, as were yesterday's, by Daesh, or ISIL, the violent offspring of the U.S. war in Iraq, the U.S.-led overthrowing of Muammar Gaddafi in Libya, and the U.S.-backed efforts to take down Bashar al-Assad's regime in Syria. Later this morning at 20 minutes past the hour, I'll be speaking about the political implications of yesterday's events in Brussels with Jean Bricmont, author of Humanitarian Imperialism, Using Human Rights to Sell War. Bricmont teaches physics at the University of Louvain in Brussels and views the terrible events in France and Belgium as a form of blowback caused by the efforts of Western governments to destabilize secular Arab regimes that had not done them any harm. That'll be about 20 minutes past the hour, so stay tuned. The past weekend saw a considerable amount of activity on Capitol Hill concerning Israel-U.S. relations, and Israel's all-powerful domestic lobby, AIPAC, was right in the center of it. First on Friday, the Institute for Research in Middle East Policy, whose director Grant Smith has been a frequent guest on this program, and the Washington Report on the Middle East hosted an all-day conference on Israel's influence on U.S. policy at the National Press Club, which attracted over 450 attendees. Only the Washington Post reported on the event, but fortunately C-SPAN recorded the entire program, which can be found online at irmep.org. Among those attending were Ralph Nader and Roger Waters of Pink Floyd, one of the most prominent proponents of the BDS, or boycott, sanctions, and divestment movement targeting Israel, about which you will hear more in a few moments from the Democratic Party's leading presidential candidate, Hillary Clinton. Clinton was the first of four presidential candidates to speak at AIPAC's largest ever national policy conference at the Verizon Center in Washington, addressing a record-breaking crowd of 18,700 at 8 a.m. Monday morning that seemed to include most, if not all, the 4,000 college students whose travel and accommodations had been paid for by AIPAC and its supporters. Her presumptive Republican opponent come November, Donald Trump, Ted Cruz, and John Kasich were given the primetime evening slots to compete for AIPAC's favors. Clinton may have sought to avoid this evening exposure, since she has been careful this time around to keep the extent of her devotion to Israel from the majority of Democratic voters who have shown in the polls that they don't share her affinity for Israel. Bernie Sanders, who has made a game run against Clinton, did what thousands of his supporters, led by Roger Waters, had demanded. He turned down AIPAC's invitation to speak and sent a statement instead. He did offer to speak to the conference by video, but AIPAC, which in the past allowed Newt Gingrich and Mitt Romney to do that, turned him down. On Monday night, Sanders appeared with Chris Hayes on CNN and described Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu as a right-wing politician and slammed Israel's decision to confiscate more Palestinian land and to build more Jewish-only settlements. Well, that would have got him lynched if he tried to say that in front of AIPAC. Yesterday's Guardian of London reported that in the statement he had prepared for AIPAC, Sanders, quote, ripped the Israeli government for its recent seizure of land on the West Bank, end quote. Sanders pointed to Israel's recent taking of 579 more acres of Palestinian land, said it is, quote, unquote, absurd for elements within the Israeli government to suggest building more settlements is an appropriate response to the most recent violence. These are difficult subjects, he said. They are hard to talk about for many Americans and for Israelis. But it is clear to me the path toward peace will require tapping into our shared humanity to make hard but just decisions, end quote. Like Clinton, Sanders calls for a two-state solution between Israelis and Palestinians, but what will upset, if not exactly surprise, many of his supporters. He also said that Palestinians must accept Israel's right to exist, as opposed to legal existence, and end attacks and terrorism against Israel. But, noted The Guardian, Sanders said it will also require security for Palestinians and an end to the blockade of Gaza and ending Israel's, quote-unquote, disproportionate responses to Palestinian attacks. Clinton's 33-minute speech to AIPAC on Monday essentially adhered to the neocon Middle East agenda and Netanyahu's off-stated position that Iran is more critical problem than ISIS, and must have gratified one of her key endorsers, Robert Kagan, who with Fox News' Bill Kristol co-founded PNAC, the Project for a New American Century, in 1997. It was PNAC, a hawkish pro-Israel front group, you'll recall, that wrote the script for the Iraq War. When things went south in Iraq in 2006, it quietly folded its tent, reappearing 3 years later as the Foreign Policy Initiative. I've edited a segment of Clinton's talk down to 8.5 minutes, cutting out all but the last of multiple rounds of applause, and left out her boilerplate remarks on the necessity of the two-state solution and her brief non-critical reference to Israeli settlements. So here it is, Hillary Clinton.
It is wonderful to be here and see so many friends. I've spoken at a lot of AIPAC conferences in the past, but this has to be one of the biggest yet. And there are so many young people here, thousands of college students from hundreds of campuses around the country. I think we should all give them a hand for being here and beginning their commitment to this important cause. You will keep the U.S.-Israel relationship going strong. You know, as a senator from New York and Secretary of State, I've had the privilege of working closely with AIPAC members to strengthen and deepen America's ties with Israel. Now I'm here as a candidate for president, and I know that all of you understand what's at stake in this election. As we gather here, three evolving threats: Iran's continued aggression, a rising tide of extremism across a wide arc of instability, and the growing effort to delegitimize Israel on the world stage are converging to make the U.S.-Israel alliance more indispensable than ever. We have to combat all these trends with even more intense security and diplomatic cooperation. The United States and Israel must be closer than ever, stronger than ever, and more determined than ever to prevail against our common adversaries and to advance our shared values. Today, Americans and Israelis face momentous choices that will shape the future of our relationship and of both our nations. The first choice is this: are we prepared to take the U.S.-Israel alliance to the next level? And if I'm fortunate enough to be elected president, the United States will reaffirm we have a strong and enduring national interest in Israel's security. And we will never allow Israel's adversaries to think a wedge can be driven between us. At a time of unprecedented chaos and conflict in the region, America needs an Israel strong enough to deter and defend against its enemies, strong enough to work with us to tackle shared challenges, and strong enough to take bold steps in the pursuit of peace. One of the first things I'll do in office is invite the Israeli Prime Minister to visit the White House, and I will send a delegation from the Pentagon and the Joint Chiefs to Israel for early consultations. Many of the young people here today are on the front lines of the battle to oppose the alarming boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement known as BDS. We must repudiate all efforts to malign, isolate, and undermine Israel and the Jewish people. We have to be united in fighting back against BDS. Many of its proponents have demonized Israeli scientists and intellectuals, even students. To all the college students who may have encountered this on campus, I hope you stay strong. Keep speaking out. Don't let anyone silence you, bully you, or try to shut down debate, especially in places of learning like colleges and universities. Now, all of this work defending Israel's legitimacy, expanding security and economic ties, taking our alliance to the next level, depends on electing a president with a deep personal commitment to Israel's future as a secure, democratic Jewish state and to America's responsibilities as a global leader. The second choice we face is whether we will have the strength and commitment to confront the adversaries that threaten us, especially Iran. For many years, we've all been rightly focused on the existential danger of Iran acquiring a nuclear weapon. After all, this remains an extremist regime that threatens to annihilate Israel. That's why I led the diplomacy to impose crippling sanctions and force Iran to the negotiating table, and why I ultimately supported the agreement that has put a lid on its nuclear program. New verification measures are in place to help us deter and detect any cheating. I really believe the United States, Israel, and the world are safer as a result. But still, it's not good enough to trust and verify. Our approach must be distrust and verify. This deal must come with vigorous enforcement, strong monitoring, clear consequences for any violations, and a broader strategy to confront Iran's aggression across the region. We cannot forget that Tehran's fingerprints are on nearly every conflict across the Middle East, from Syria to Lebanon to Yemen. Our next president has to be able to hold together our global coalition and impose real consequences for even the smallest violations of this agreement. We must maintain the legal and diplomatic architecture to turn all the sanctions back on if needed. If I'm elected, the leaders of Iran will have no doubt that if we see any indication that they are violating their commitments not to seek, develop, or acquire nuclear weapons, the United States will act to stop it, and that we will do so with force if necessary. We must also continue to enforce existing sanctions and impose additional sanctions as needed. The United States and Israel also have to stand together against the threat from ISIS and other radical jihadists. This is a threat that knows no borders. I've laid out a plan to take the fight to ISIS from the air, on the ground with local forces, and online where they recruit and inspire. Our goal cannot be to contain ISIS. We must defeat ISIS. There is one more choice that we face together. Will we, as Americans and as Israelis, stay true to the shared democratic values that have always been at the heart of our relationship? We are both nations built by immigrants and exiles seeking to live and worship in freedom. Nations built on principles of equality, tolerance, and pluralism. At our best, both Israel and America are seen as a light unto the nations because of those values. This is the real foundation of our alliance. Together, let's defend the shared values that already make America and Israel great. Let us do the hard work necessary to keep building our friendship and reach out to the next generation of Americans and Israelis so the bond bonds between our nations grow even deeper and stronger. We are stronger together. And if we face the future side by side, I know for both Israel and America, our best days are still ahead. Thank you so much.
And that was Hillary Clinton receiving a standing round of applause at her speech for AIPAC, in front of AIPAC on Monday morning. Her entire speech can be found on AIPAC's website, if you have the stomach for it. If a presidential candidate or an American politician spoke with such reverence and affection about any other country besides Israel, there would at the very least be a public uproar. But there won't be at this time. But I guarantee you most of those who have voted for or will vote for Clinton will never get or take the opportunity to hear that speech. Nor will they learn about her role in fomenting the current situation in Syria, as revealed in one of her private emails on December 31, 2012, now declassified and released by WikiLeaks. It confirmed that the Obama administration deliberately provoked the civil war in Syria as, in Clinton's words, the best way to help Israel. The quote, "The best way to help Israel deal with Iran's growing nuclear capability is to help the people of Syria overthrow the regime of Bashar Assad," Clinton began the email. "Iran's nuclear program and Syria's civil war may seem unconnected," she wrote, "but they are. What Israel military leaders really worry about but cannot talk about is losing their nuclear monopoly. An Iranian nuclear weapons capability would not only end that nuclear monopoly," wrote Clinton, "but could also prompt other adversaries like Saudi Arabia and Egypt to go nuclear as well. The result would be a precarious nuclear balance in which Israel could not respond to provocations with conventional military strikes on Syria and Lebanon as it can do today. If Iran were to reach the threshold of a nuclear weapons state, Tehran would find it much easier to call on its allies in Syria and Hezbollah to strike Israel, knowing that its nuclear weapons would serve as a deterrent to Israel responding against Iran itself. It is," Clinton continued, "the strategic relationship between Iran and the regime of Bashar Assad in Syria that makes it positive for Iran to undermine Israel's security. This would not come through a direct attack," Clinton admits, "because in the 30 years of hostility between Iran and Israel, this has never occurred, but through its alleged proxies." Well, that was Hillary Clinton. Also wrote, in short, she said, "The White House can ease the tensions that has developed with Israel over Iran by doing the right thing in Syria. With his life and family at risk, only the threat of use of force will change the Syrian dictator Bashar Assad's mind." From this message, one can make the argument that the refugee crisis, which currently engulfs Europe, was directly sparked by the U.S. government, with Hillary Clinton right in the center of it. Finally, today in San Francisco, the Board of Regents of the University of California is meeting to decide whether or not anti-Zionism, that is, opposition to Israel as an exclusive Jewish state, can be equated with anti-Semitism and thus suppress protests against Israel's settlements, its siege of Gaza, and its unending violence against Palestinians on University of California campuses. A so-called working group of the regents has come up with a paper entitled "Principles Against Intolerance," stating that it does. 26 states have already passed legislation that virtually criminalizes the BDS movement. Can one imagine what it would be like in South Africa had that apartheid regime had a lobby in the U.S. as powerful as Israel's? This is Jeff Blankford. Thank you for listening.